Mike Malevsky, and I'm here with Mark Kelsey. Welcome, Mark.
Good morning, Mike.
And I'm here with Zaz Hollander. Welcome, Zaz.
Hi, Mike. Good to be here.
And we are all here with Terry Snyder. Welcome, Terry.
Morning, Mike and all.
So let's begin. I'm going to take advantage of the presence of Zaz Hollander, because one of the ongoing stories, one of the things that many people have been talking about and looking at and pondering the implications of, is the extension from what appeared as the Grunewald murder case. Zaz, what's the update on that?
Well, the update is that a completely different 16-year-old who died in June, a kid named Frank Woodford, was with one of the five teenagers charged in the Grunewald murder, Austin Barrett, and the brother of another, a guy named Damian Peterson, when he died. And he died of a gunshot wound to his chest, which initially was not ruled a suicide, but also not investigated as a homicide. And the troopers have since reopened that case after the Grunewald murder came to light and the people involved in the murder came to light. And so the story, it's in today's paper, but there have been no arrests made. Austin Barrett has not been arrested in Frank Woodford's death. He's in jail right now on the Grunewald case. Damian Peterson has not been charged in this case. But if nothing else, and there may be more to come, I don't know. But if nothing else, this shows that this group of teens was, and probably not alone, but seemed to be escalating over the summer. You know, whatever it was they were doing, if these accusations are correct, and nobody's been convicted on anything, that seemed to be escalating. And a lot of it seemed to center around this same kind of core group of kids. And I think one of the broader ramifications of the Grunewald story for the rest of us who maybe didn't know the family personally is, what does this mean for our community? Mm-hmm. You know, is this a problem throughout our community? And I can't answer that question, but a lot of this goes back to this group of kids. And it's, you know, there are some people I've talked to who know the circles they run in and say it really is. This is sort of a nexus, maybe not the only one. Certainly these kids aren't responsible for all the wrongdoing in the valley. But it does seem like there was something going on this summer with that group into the fall. Most of them had, some of them anyway, had parents, had homes, may or may not have been there, were crashing at maybe even one particular home with adults present. And so there's just a lot more questions and answers. But the involvement of Barrett, he had three separate, this shooting was one, there was a theft case about a week earlier, and then 2 days later, Austin Barrett and Devin Peterson and Damian Peterson were involved in a kidnap assault case in Eagle River and Wasilla. So just bizarre, kind of sketchy stuff.
Did the parents know each other at all? Or does it seem like they were interacting at all before? Or
not in the way that, you know, more conventional parents mm-hmm. might, seeing each other at school and maybe socializing a little or calling mm-hmm. each other or texting. I mean, I don't know about texting,
yeah.
but I'm not getting a sense that they all knew each other that well. Mm-hmm. One of the weird things about the Grunewald defendants, though, is a number of their parents have told me, Eric Allmendinger's parents, and Devin Peterson's mom said that, yeah, we had these kids over for sleepovers, which is kind of normal. You know, mm-hmm. these, you know, all these kids at one time were at my house kind of mm-hmm. thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know at the borough assembly meeting, there was a young woman that came up and testified.
Yeah, I
very
heard
quickly.
That.
Yeah,
I didn't
just,
catch her name.
Yeah, I didn't really. I probably have it written down, but and made a reference to the case.
And that was asking that marijuana be banned. I think she was obviously upset.
I think it's interesting that I like the way you put it as a nexus, because it seems like there's a. I think that's a concern of the community: is did my kid know these kids? And if so, what was their interaction with my kids? And really know what's going on with my
kids? Right.
Kid,
I mean, that is the takeaway, I think, if at least part of it is, you know, by all appearances, David Grunewald was a more conventional kid than we usually expect to get involved mm-hmm. with kids like this. But he did. I mean, he was at least marginally involved with one mm-hmm. of them. So.
Mm-hmm. The thing that, well, but there were a lot of things that I found fascinating about the recent story, the rehash of the Woodford death. But I think the thing, as I read through it, that just hung over me, mystifying me, was what were all those people doing in that house? It seemed odd. Adults upstairs doing laundry, kids over
washing
here watching
a baby
TV,
at midnight.
Working on your car outside.
And there was, yeah. I should say that in the report, and this was cut from the story, but the lead investigator said there was drug paraphernalia in the room where Frank Woodford was shot. And that could mean anything, and that's one of the reasons it wasn't in the story.
So they didn't specify it was a needle or a pipe?
I'm assuming it was some kind of a bong or something pot-related, but I have no idea because it wasn't in there and the troopers didn't return my request for information.
So did they take the gun and do fingerprints, or is that
That's unclear, and the problem is everybody's fingerprints, at least according to Damien's story, his fingerprints would have been on it from the story he told, and so would Frank Woodford's because he was playing with it, so...
So this was
residue
another...
is another question. I don't know if a Glock. I don't know enough about weapons, but I'm not sure that a Glock has residue.
Well, what I took away was that, unlike our experience watching a TV series of police procedural, where you walk through and come up with an answer, this event where the victim was reported to have said, I didn't shoot myself.
A couple times said.
A couple times.
Didn't say who did.
But and with all that might be available in an investigation and interviewing, et cetera, ended up being a case that was sort of put on the shelf until the Grunewald case.
Yeah, and I want to be clear, you know, I have no evidence that the troopers made a mistake here. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's a lot of that.
It's complicated.
And I know that you're not saying that either, Mike, but I just want to be clear about that there's a lot of chatter on social media about how could the troopers let this. I mean, there were 7 separate troopers on the report that I saw. So, you know, who knows what.
Well, and that's part
what
of
they
reopening
didn't do.
An investigation, right, is to going back and talk to the witnesses again and replaying. I mean, there'll be EMS people. There'll be all kinds of people.
Or other people who were there who weren't brought into the first. Mm-hmm. Who knows? Mm-hmm.
Do you know what caused the linkage and the reopening of the case?
I can only speculate because the troopers and the DA's office wouldn't specifically answer my questions. I mean, there were sort of leading answers that, yes, this happened after the Grunewald investigation from the troopers and from the DA. Often when there's a major case, we go back over and look at the people involved. Mm-hmm. The last entry in the incident report was mid-November, and I asked the troopers about that and didn't get an answer. It was November 17th, which was long before they had any of the Grunewald defendants in custody. Mm. By then, I'm trying to remember the timeline on the Grunewald investigation, if they even had. By then, they may have had Eric Allmendinger's tablet. And so I think that was when they were really starting to ramp up. That may have been the trigger. If I had to guess, it would be that.
Well, there was a second incident, of course, not long ago in Fort Lauderdale that involved someone from Alaska. And I think Charles Woolforth, in particular, in an article, took a look at something that he has written about in the past, which is the mental health process for determining someone is in need of more than just a brief interview or whatever. And I think looking at that and also knowing that we've had a significant revision in the criminal justice or legislation, if you will, in process, I think both of these cases seem to be raising the question, is there more that can be done in terms, I'm not sure what, to prevent people when they, in particular, I think the commonality is if someone comes to the attention of the police, the FBI, how do you make that determination while protecting the privacy rights and rights of individuals? That once again, a difficult question seems to be made more prominent because of these events.
Well, I mean, that's a really sticky one, and you guys probably know more about that, having your backgrounds in reporting. But, you know, to me, what it screams to me is, where is the prevention programs? Where are the programs? I mean, I know a few judges that I've had conversations with, and, I mean, they know even if somebody should get treatment if they live so far away with no transportation? How is that person going to get to treatment? And are there treatment programs? And do we have programs where it can be identified early? And, I mean, you can go down the whole rabbit trail of that. I mean, in the schools, do we have we've cut all our counselors in schools now because that's one of the easy low-hanging fruit was we don't need as many school counselors. And to me, it all kind of goes back. It's kind of a domino effect of a lot of programs that we've chosen not to support. And so the red flags just never get up for people that might need the help, whether it's a bed that's not available or it's a counselor that's not available. I mean, I think we have to look at the whole system holistically, even before we get to the rights thing, because if we're not serving the public in those capacities, I think that's really where the hole is in the system. But
I think it's in Alaska, we're dealing with an overtaxed, underfunded mental health, behavioral mm-hmm. health system, mm-hmm. and federally as well. I mean, with the VA, right, mm-hmm. and with other behavioral health providers. And so SB 91, the mm-hmm. legislation that you referenced, Mike, has a treatment component. You know, it's aimed at saving money because we're running out of money, and we have a spending cut suggesting at least some legislators. SB 91 is ostensibly designed to save money in terms of incarceration costs and supplant that maybe with treatment. And there is money for treatment in the bill, but there's a really woefully underfunded API, as Charles Wolforth mm-hmm. wrote about, got a brand new facility with nice paintings on the wall, but what, 80 beds? A drastic reduction in beds. And so they're just having to triage people and prioritize where they can and put people out otherwise, or send them, you know, 72 hours and send them someplace else. And so there, it is inevitable that someone is going to slip through the cracks, like the shooter that we're all reading about. But, he is the absolute worst case scenario. Who knows how many others like him are out there.
Like the canary in the coal mine.
Yeah. The AP reported that he was, you know, people at the liquor store across the street from his motel could see him waving his arms around and having an argument with himself. You know, he was one of those quote unquote crazies that we all see. And well, there he didn't have a support network, you know, and he absolutely fell through the cracks.
Right. Well, let's switch from this story, which will be ongoing, I am sure, to another one which will be ongoing, I'm equally sure, and that is the budget. I think the most interesting thing, perhaps, once it's been reviewed for its value, is the suggestions that Senator Dunleavy has made regarding the budget. He's put that out. I'm having trouble seeing, is this so obviously a good thing that people have just missed it? And this is a real way to solve the problem, does it skate over a number of details that will make it merely a talking point? Mark?
We should be so past the point where we're talking in generalities, just saying cut, cut, cut. It sounds great to people, and it has a certain appeal to, you know, one segment of voters, but really, this has been going on for way too long. If you don't have specifics, stop talking about it.
Yeah, as I understand the presentation of his plan, it's a multi-year plan that starts out by saying no new taxes of any sort, which grabs people's attention, and protect the permanent fund dividend, and provide cuts with a kind of a percentage applied over the years. But as you're pointing out, Mark, nothing that I saw that was very specific about, where are these? Who does this, et cetera? I think equally interesting, maybe even more interesting to me, is the announcement about the same time of John Henry Heckendorn moving from being a very successful consultant for legislative races, 6 wins, to being the special advisor to Governor Walker. That's captured my attention in an interesting way because of his reputation, his apparent success, And bringing in someone who might just be able to assist the governor as he moves along. Any comments about that?
Well, I would say first and foremost, it seems to make it way more likely that Walker's interested in running for re-election.
That popped into my head, too. Terry, have you had any observations about the
NRA? Well, you know, I know Johnny's a brilliant guy. He knows exactly what he's doing. I was told when he got to Alaska that I should check him out because he's probably the most brilliant young mind that's come to Alaska in a long time, and I found him to be lived up to that. So good for Walker. You know, it's kind of like, I was thinking about it a little bit this morning. It's kind of like getting divorced, and you go out and hire the best attorney that is out there because they can't work for the other guy. There's probably a little bit of that too, because he's worked on both sides of the fence, both Democratic and Republican campaigns. So I think that's good. But I don't want to jump too quick without the Dunleavy talk, because I think there is a difference there. I mean, math is hard. We all know that. But what's harder are moral decisions. And when we keep electing people that morally won't tell us where they're at by just throwing out numbers, and then they move the goalpost when, you know, they want to look at their own successes more important to them than the success of the state, I think you can take the temperature and realize you've elected some pretty people that aren't looking out for your best interest. And I don't know how much support he will get for this. Because I think it's sad, like Mark says, after all this talk, that people still don't understand the math when it comes to what we need to run the state. It sort of reminds me of the argument we're having on affordable health care now. You know, people don't realize the importance of having affordable, accessible health care and the gift that you have for so many people to have it. All they know is the rates have gone up, but they don't stop to realize the rates have gone up less fast, at least, than they were going up before we had an Affordable Health Care Act. So people just aren't paying attention, and that's why these type of tactics like Senator Dunleavy has put out there may and possibly will work.
So you have mentioned the Affordable Care Act, and I'd like to broaden our scope of vision to include the two U.S. senators from Alaska, Murkowski and company. And they have, Senator Sullivan, as well as Senator Murkowski, been quoted and have seemed to voted with statements that say, we recognize that back home in Alaska, there are three particularly large populations that we want to be careful about. They include those individuals cared under the VA, those that are involved with the Indian Health Service, and seniors. And there are others as well. But they have been expressing, it seems to me, caution about acting precipitously if there's to be a redo or change, a follow-on to the Affordable Care Act. And because those ripples can have a dramatic effect back here. And any comments about their positions or any of that?
Well, yeah, sure. I've got a general one. It seemed to go from very quickly, it turned from looking like there was a movement even among some Republicans to push, let's hold off on this, let's take our time, let's figure it out. And then all of a sudden it seemed to be on a dime that all went away and they all voted to repeal anyway. It seems like there was – like there may have been something going on behind the scenes that folks like us just were really not privy to.
I think there's going to be a lot of that in this administration. I've even heard that the nominee for Secretary of State has voiced the fact that he may not have a traveling press corps should he be appointed, approved, I should say. But anyway, I think that there are clear problems with the Affordable Care Act that any number of kind of bipartisan groups have advocated fixing. But the criticism now, even from conservatives, is that what plan there might be to replace it is not workable, is not a good plan. But even President-elect Trump, after he met with President Obama, was signaling that he wasn't going to shred the Affordable Care Act. And so I guess we should expect that to change because he has at least so far shown to be fairly changeable from one day to the other.
Yeah, watch what I don't watch what I say, watch what I do. I think this is really, as far as Murkowski and Sullivan, is just an indication that major policy decisions in this state are done in the Beltway. They're not done from Alaska. That's just who sets policy, and that's the way it is. But I think what's amazing to me about the ultra-conservative stance on this, about, you know, having that statement of getting rid of Obamacare, is they are the party of responsibility, taking responsibility. And what better responsibility do you have is taking responsibility of your own health and having a system where everybody can take benefit of it. I don't think you get anybody to say it was a perfect system. It never was never really put out there as a perfect system. But to go almost 7 years and not have a system to go to get ready and just repeal with nothing to replace just seems really disingenuous to me, and that's pretty light.
Well, my understanding of the most recent vote, the vote on party lines in the Senate in particular, was that we want to separate out two things. One, procedural aspects of this whole thing to allow the rest of the story to happen with repealing of elements. Because as I understand, it's not possible to just repeal it, because it consists of a whole series of elements, some of which are beyond the reach of the Senate to act quickly on. And this is a procedural vote that allowed for the rest of the story to play out piece by piece. And that's where the arguments and discussions will go on about, do we get rid of, if we do this, how do we take care of it? What do we put in place of it? I agree with you fully, Terry, that that one would think you would have the plan, which has been vetted and looked at, et cetera. But to do that kind of work requires the kinds of hearings and discussions, et cetera, that I don't believe part of the Congress that wants to repeal has been involved in doing. Mm-hmm. They've been focused on how do we take the first step procedurally and start repealing it. And there's been just the barest idea of what that would look like.
That was a fairly close vote, too, if I remember right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Well, right across party lines.
Well, so
in the Senate?
Yeah. We're going to hear more about that as well. We have a few moments left. And what I'm curious about is this question. For listeners, for myself, maybe from your own experience, we spend a lot of time looking at a lot of information, news, et cetera. What standard do you use? What are the techniques you use to determine what is real and what is faux news? Mark?
I'll tell you, I think it's pretty easy to tell in most cases. And I don't know, I get red flags pretty quickly, and they're almost always right. If nobody else is reporting a story, you know, be skeptical. If it seems incredible, it might be. And look at the outlet, too. If you don't recognize, you know, Time, Newsweek, Fox, MSNBC, whatever, if it's a name that you don't readily know and understand, definitely check it out. It doesn't take long. Google the headline, Google the theme. If nothing else comes up, there's a pretty good chance it's not real.
Okay. Zaz.
Well, I guess would BuzzFeed fall in that group of credible media at this point?
BuzzFeed, they were very clear. It's not like they put that out as a news story. They were very clear. They did backflips in their disclaimer. We have not verified this. Things that have been verified, we know that there are falsehoods. They were very clear. They were not saying, here's a news story, here's some facts. Mm-hmm. They were putting it out. And it's hard to argue with the logic that says lots of elected officials have seen this, lots of news outlets have seen this. Why shouldn't everybody else get to see it?
Mm-hmm.
I think that does change.
Properly disclaimered as it was.
Right. It sort of changes the bar when it's not the thing itself that is necessarily the news, but who has seen it and how the levels to which it's gone. I mean, that the BuzzFeed release of that information is causing a huge and really interesting conversation in the media industry, the real media industry. I think it is dismaying to see fake news trotted out from the new administration as an excuse for not liking a story. I think that's mm-hmm. really disturbing.
Mm-hmm. Using the label.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't like it. It's fake news. CNN, you're a fake news reporter. And I've watched CNN, and I have to admit there's times where I don't think they're fake news, but it's like, come on, guys, get back on the ball. But I think that in terms of how you can sort the wheat from the chaff, be sourcing, attribution, you know, where is this coming from? Who are they quoting? And the source itself. Okay. Where is this coming from?
Terry.
Yeah, I think that he could have substituted fake news by my news. I only trust my news, not fake news, you know. You know, what I do is I've got several news sources that I can depend on, and that's where I go. I mean, I know the reporters that I think are fact checkers. I'm sitting next to one right now, but you decide what your sources are, and I'm sure you can read the other stuff, but the other sources aren't reporting it. I think there's a pretty good chance that you should wait before you react to it, at least. I think it's coming so fast and furious, and some are really good and very convincing. But I almost always, even when I see one that I think is very left-leaning, I Google beyond that and make sure that it's been reported by, you know, a Washington Post or, you know, by a reporter.
Good for you. Very responsible.
Yeah. And, you know, it's easy to just get lazy and say,
especially if it's something that you want to believe.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
The echo chamber effect.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. But I think we do have a responsibility knowing, and I've been guilty of this. I've seen some things come through that I think that's so outrageous and I don't respond and I don't even stop and say, hey, wait a minute, guys, you know, that's not true. You know, I think we all have a responsibility at this point in time, because there's so much of that, to put your hand up and say, and you can do it in the nicest of ways, say, maybe you didn't know that was not a trusted source, or please, you know, rethink whether this is a good source or something. But I think we have not done enough of that, because we have a certain responsibility to protect the journalists that are out there doing the work, checking their sources, and promoting their work, as opposed to people that are just trying to sell ads and clicks.
Well, let me throw in here, since I've asked the question of you, and I've come around. I agree with what you're saying about source verification and so on, that there's one thing that I've learned that seems to be helpful, and whether I'm speaking with someone who's giving me news or a rumor, is simply to say, well, thank you. Tell me more. I need to clarify that. I don't quite understand what you're saying. Tell me more about that. And see where that goes. If I have the opportunity in any way to check with someone who is a source of information, okay, and this is a little bit different than coming across a news article, but I do the same thing through my mind of saying, okay, I have this here. Well, what is there more about this that tells me more than just this surface level is what being presented? Because if there's nothing behind it, then very often what it is a bold statement, but not necessarily a fact. So that's part of what. But as luck would have it, we have run out of time. So I want to thank the panel. Mark Kelsey, thank you, Mark.
You're welcome. Have a good week.
And Zaz Hollander, thank you, Zaz.
Yeah, you're very welcome, Mike.
And Terry Snyder, thank you, Terry.
Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow, I get back from Anchorage in the morning.
Well, thank you all very much for helping with another edition of Valley Edition. We'll be back next week.